Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social, or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals, and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks.
Happy dry January, Felicity. Are you observing?
I am not, Luli. Are you?
Absolutely not. No, never. Worst month to go sober.
All right, now we've got that out of the way, I have a question for you.
Good.
On this topic, are no and low alcohol drinks succeeding because people are walking away from alcohol? Or is it because the economy and new habits are forcing everybody to change how, when, and where they drink?
Okay, so do you mean, are we actually drinking less or just differently?
Oh, yes, that's exactly what I mean. Thank you for putting it so neatly.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. So this leads us into the world of consumer behaviour and market data, Felicity. So two of my favourite topics.
Okay, so that's all very technical. So in my world, what I mean by that is, who's buying this stuff? Why are they buying these drinks? When are they drinking them? And most importantly, are these drinks pulling people away from alcohol, or are they being used for different occasions entirely?
So in other words, is no and low alcohol a sideshow or one of the most important shifts in demand the drinks industry has seen in decades? So, Felicity, let's start off with a quick quiz.
Oh, you always do this to me. I don't know the answer. Just take it right now. I don't know the answer. Give me the answer to whatever you're going to ask.
I know. Small pleasures, Felicity. Small pleasures. So when wine drinkers decide to moderate, what do they actually switch to instead of their glass of wine? And this is according to data from IWSR.
It's like my friends, it's tonic water and cranberry juice. I don't know, sparkling water. I don't know, some sort of shrub. Tell me.
Okay, nope. You were kind of getting there, so you're doing quite well on the quiz today. So it's actually quite boring. The answer is water followed by tea and coffee.
That's really interesting. I would have thought it was elderflower juice plucked at midnight or something.
No, afraid not. We are just after hydration, and caffeine, basically.
That's really funny, because I understand water, but I would have thought caffeine drinks were playing a completely different role, because they've got their own rituals and they take them for different reasons and so on. Okay, but I take your word. You know what you're talking about.
Well, the data never lies. Well, actually,
no, of course
anyway.
Not.
Anyway, so should we put this into context then?
All right, so everybody I go to LinkedIn is talking about launching low and no variants, and they're all getting into newspapers because of their amazing drinks, and everybody's saying we're now drinking less, and Gen Z is sober, and The Economist ran a piece saying it could be the end of alcohol. The pubs are empty, though that may be to do with duty. Is any of this actually true? What's happening, Luli? Tell us.
Okay, so one of my usual unhelpful answers, as always, Felicity, both and neither. So it depends how far back we go.
No, you can't have it both ways. You can't do the house and hedgy thing. Be more useful. Say what you mean.
Okay, I'm going to try and be more. You're pushing me today. Try and be more useful. So let's start with the big picture.
It's my year's resolution, Luli. We're going to get straight to the point.
Oh, God. Oh, I'm worried now for future podcasts and this one. Okay, so let's start with the big picture. The global volume of alcohol being consumed is down. But I would say this is probably more of a correction than an absolute collapse.
I've opened the pause. Go on.
Okay. So you're waiting. Okay. So, yeah, this is your new, like, dig in there, Luli, and actually tell us what's
yeah,
going
that's
on.
Right.
So,
get to the point.
Get to the point, woman. So let's go back to the 1970s and through actually into the 80s. So alcohol consumption rises almost everywhere in the West. So the US, UK, Australia, France, Germany, effectively all up.
Yes, it was rising prosperity and new norms around boozy lunches and also women entering the workforce and so on.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of post-war optimism, rising incomes, looser rules, and really importantly, the boomers kind of hitting peak drinking age, plus wine at lunch.
And martinis. I was just reading about the three martini lunch. Isn't that amazing?
It is. And are you speaking from experience again, Felicity?
No, I read about it, Lily.
Read. Okay. A friend told me, yeah. So then we hit global peak of alcohol consumption actually in around the early 1990s.
Okay. So technically speaking, we've been drinking less for about 30 years.
In some places, yes, but there is a geographical split.
All right, yes. And this is important. It's always important to look at where this is happening, not just talking generic terms.
Yeah, exactly. So Western Europe starts to drift down over time. So particularly in countries like France, Italy and Spain, which get this, lose about 30 to 50%, depending on the country, of total volume. But we must remember, you know, we're starting from a really high volumetric per adult consumption starting point.
And just for listeners, at this point, we've switched to talking about wine. We're not talking about ethanol. So we're not talking about alcohol generally. So we're talking about wine. And it's worth remembering just how sort of wine-focused Europe used to be. In places like France and Italy, wine was an indulgence. It was basically a food group with adults routinely drinking the equivalent of a bottle a day. And in fact, I remember being told by people who were like au pair girls in Paris and places in the 70s and 80s that often they were paid in alcohol. It was really
good. Lord.
Yeah.
Good right. Lord.
In fact, during the 50s in France, they gave wine to kids at school.
Yes. And that didn't stop, actually, till relatively recently. So at the same time, if we're doing sort of a very quick geographical look at alcohol consumption over the last 30 years, in Eastern Europe, alcohol consumption spikes, then crashes after regulation. But in Asia, and especially in China, at this point in the 90s, we're seeing consumption of alcohol climbing.
Yes. So the point being, when people say things like we're drinking less, they're talking about the parts of the world that they're most familiar with.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much.
Yeah. All right. So and then what happened when we got to the 2010s?
Okay, so global consumption stabilised. So World Health Organization data shows it hovering around, okay, getting technical here, 6.3 to 6.5 litres of pure alcohol per adult.
Yeah, so pure alcohol is really important. This is what governments measure. Do you want to know why?
Yeah, exactly. And it's clearly because we don't consume ethanol, you know, in its raw sense. But what this allows us to do is to compare beer, wine, spirits, and more recently, RTDs properly.
That's right. So you're looking at what the overall consumption of ethanol is. So if the ethanol is stable, it could mean that wine is going down, but beer is going up. And if the ethanol is going down, that means that people are drinking less. Okay, so after this, we get COVID, we get the on-trade collapse, we get off-trade spikes, we get people drinking at home, weird times, we get fewer people, all of that.
Yeah, and by 2023, so both again, the World Health Organization and IWSR show a consistent global decline, not just a blip.
And this brings us to a quite recent Economist article asking if this is the end of alcohol.
Yeah, which is, okay, I'm going to say I think that statement is, you know, the end of alcohol is a bit overcooked. So this is my reasoning. Reasoning. I'm going to give you some data to support why I've drawn that conclusion. So let's take the UK as an example. So according to the Financial Times recently, citing IWSR, the average UK adult now drinks 10.2 drinks a week, which is the lowest since records began in 1990 and down more than 25% from its peak in the early 2000s.
Gosh. Okay, that's actually quite dramatic. And it seems to contradict the idea that we've been gradually drinking less for the last 30 years.
Yes, until we put it into context. So again, another example in the US, Reuters, again reporting IWSR data recently, show total alcohol volumes again are at their lowest in the US since 2005. But, and this is kind of the point I'm making, but when you convert that to weekly drinks per adults, Americans have hovered at around 10 to 12 drinks a week since the 1970s. So today's levels, yes, they are at their lowest since 1995, but it's only about one drink per week lower than that real peak in COVID. So proportionally...
Okay, so I'm trying to work all of that out in my head. That's actually a bit tricky to work out. But I think what this means, you're saying, is there's a rebalancing going on.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And a pullback from an unusually high baseline that we had during COVID, or some parts of the world had during COVID. But people aren't quitting alcohol. They're just drinking less often, so on fewer occasions, and being choosier.
Well, hang on a second. Does the data actually say that? Because I think, you know, the data could say the declines are coming from, if you look at the overall population, there's a greater proportion of people in the population who are not drinking at all, rather than from drinkers changing the way that they behave.
Yeah, well, again, one of my really useful answers is the data clearly points to both. So there are fewer people proportionally drinking alcohol, but the key driver of the decline in the volume of alcohol consumed is actually more by people who are drinking on fewer occasions and less volume per occasion, rather than people abstaining altogether. So actually the real crux of this is that it's changing behaviours, not to a, you know, huge proportions of abstinence, but just this sort of moderation of frequency and volume per occasion.
Have you changed your own behaviour, Lily?
Do you know what, actually, Felicity, I have. So the what for me was a quite frequent on many evenings glass of wine whilst cooking in the evenings. We have now deliberately filled our fridge with soft drinks that we really like, so kind of lime and lemonade and things like that. And so now the first glass of wine is when we sit down for dinner. So we have effectively halved our alcohol consumption during the week.
Right. So you are an exemplar of what
yes.
you're talking about.
Yeah, because we haven't stopped drinking. We've just gone, actually, we don't need two glasses of wine every evening. One will do. Should I be admitting that?
I'll tell you, my own drinking has changed dramatically. And it's mostly I've stopped drinking during the week because I realised, like everybody else, I've got a smartwatch and it's showing me that it wrecks my sleep. So now I just do it on the weekend. So I'm part of this picture as well, I think.
Yeah, and except you're doing it in a much better way than me, because I'm not saying I'm opting out during the week. I'm just saying I'm reducing it.
Well, we're still talking about the same pattern, aren't we? So So I think that shows your point. All right. So before we move on, could we talk about Latin America and Mexico? Because, you know, every time we do global trends, we get messages saying, "Can we do more of this part of the world, please?"
Yeah, actually, a really good point, because actually we were encouraged by a listener who got in touch with us to say exactly that. Can we have more LATAM data and you discussing that? So that's a fair point.
Yes, and it is a complicated region.
Yeah, very. So LATAM is one of the most volatile alcohol regions in the last 50 years in terms of consumption. So as we know, historically, it's been focused, or primarily the consumption has been beer and sugarcane spirits, so catasha and rum and high volume, sort of very social.
But that's shifted in the late 90s.
Yeah, gradually. So you see premium global spirits coming in, for example, especially in countries like Brazil, Mexico and Chile.
So Mexico first, you've got beer plus tequila.
Yeah, exactly. But beer still dominates, but agave kind of pulls the whole market premium with it. And even with younger drinkers moderating, as we have been discussing, volumes still really stay quite resilient because alcohol is kind of culturally embedded.
And what do you know about Brazil?
Historically huge beer. Now beer is premiumizing, growing strong growth in, from a small base, admittedly, sparkling wine culture, partly because of domestic production as well as import there. There is a momentum in Brazil for low and no. It's still really early days, but you can kind of see that momentum starting to build.
Yeah, Brazil's interesting. I went there about 10 years ago when the wine trade was really taking off, and it's going to become a very important wine country now.
Yeah.
What else? Wine countries?
Yeah, yeah. So if we'd think about Chile and Argentina, so being the kind of primary production regions for wine, they mirror the patterns there. We see mirror Southern Europe, so long-term wine decline, again, shift more towards spirits, particularly premium spirits, and RTDs for younger adults, as we see in the US.
All right. So is there a unifying thread running through all of this?
Oh, that's a big question, Felicity. So sort of economic volatility, younger populations, and alcohol as social glue. So LATAM isn't sobering up necessarily. It's like other markets sort of recalibrating.
So this brings us back to your original point. Mm.
Yeah, exactly. So volumes are down, but value is typically stable or even up.
And that's because in some quarters, I'm not going to say all of it, people are buying and drinking less, but maybe better.
Yeah, correct. But this is a longer term trend and probably, as I was saying earlier, more a correction than a total collapse. So the real change isn't whether people drink, as we were just sharing from both of our experience, it's how, where, and most importantly, how often.
Right. Now, as everybody knows, I'm the cynic on the podcast. And I think
really?
that's all great. But actually, if you look at some of the data, particularly, you know, we're talking about a sort of gradual easing off. But if you look at things like the Gallup data in the US, it looks a lot more dramatic than that. It's not a gentle slope and a gentle easing off. It's a drop off.
Yes, and the Gallup study matters because they've been asking essentially the same core question, get this, since 1939 amongst US adults.
Oh, okay. What have they been asking?
Okay, so you ready for this, Felicity? So the question they ask is, do you have occasion to use alcoholic beverages such as liquor, wine or beer, or are you a total abstainer?
Oh, this confirms my very strong belief that America is in urgent need of adopting the kind of plain English movement that swept through UK and Australia in the 1990s. You know, if you log onto the NHS website or something, you can actually understand what it says. It's because there was this concerted effort to write in such a way that people could understand. And the Americans don't do this, which, you know, if you've ever used one of their tax forms. Anyway, so rant over. What on earth do they mean by have occasion to use?
Okay, so because the question was originally written in 1939, Gallup are obsessed with reliability. So that's a geeky data way of saying kind of consistency over time. So same wording, decade after decade, so that they can look at the trends and they're comparable, which is, by the way, a really good thing in statistics and data and tracking studies.
Yeah, I'm sure. But I can feel there's a but coming, Luli.
Naturally. So reliability, which isn't the same as validity, basically is, are you measuring the thing that you think you're measuring?
I've got no idea what you're talking about. Could you translate that, please?
Okay, I'll translate. Yeah. So the way people talked about drinking in 1939 isn't, as you've just pointed out, how we talk about it today. So the wording hasn't changed because they wanted to keep the reliability, which means that the wording is now kind of outdated and doesn't make so much sense to us when we're answering that question. But there's also a second point about the Gallup study, which is that, you get ready for this, Gallup still uses telephone surveys. So they literally do random digit dialing, landlines and mobiles, to reach respondents.
God, that's hilarious. So, I mean, how many people actually pick up an unknown number in 2025 or 26?
Exactly.
And do some people, you know, just by probability, get asked year after year, and then some years they're like, why hasn't Callum called me? That's hilarious.
Yeah, exactly. So clearly there is going to be some bias in the response sample that we get. So consistent, yes, but old school. But having kind of pulled that apart from a researcher's point of view, the pattern, as you said, is still striking, and we should, we should observe that pattern and take it seriously.
Yes. So what do you think of the poll?
Yeah. So
the results.
Yeah. So what they show is that in 2025, just over half of US adults say they drink alcohol. And that's the lowest that they've recorded in more than 80 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, this, I think, does speak to the idea that in the US, anyway, let's talk about regions, it is a drop-off, not an easement. I mean, the study also showed that attitudes have really changed. So 53% of Americans now say that even moderate drinking is bad for your health.
Yeah.
And a decade ago, that was only 28%. So it does sound like those, you know, no safe level messages are taking over.
Mm. Yeah. Except, yeah, sort of yes and no, when we're talking about abstinence. So the key point, again, from the recent reporting in Financial Times and Reuters that I was just referring to, really shows that teetotalism isn't rising. Moderation is doing the work, basically, as I said earlier, in terms of total volume of alcohol reduction.
Meaning,
you're going to push me today, aren't you? Fewer people are drinking frequently, and when they do drink, smaller amounts per occasion. So not a mass shift to zero consumption.
Yes. I mean, so there's a lot of things going on. As we know, there's ageing, there's health consciousness, and of course, there's cost of living.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of what we've seen, particularly in the last year or so, is financially we just can't afford to drink as much, and particularly drink as much when we're out in the on-premise.
I can really see that. Just in my town, there's two wine bars here, and I can see that there are far fewer people than there used to be this time a year ago. All right, so before we leave this topic, we should tackle the topic of Gen Z, the generation that kills drinking. What do you think?
Okay, so absolutely, because the data, again, if we look at it, doesn't necessarily say that Gen Z have stopped drinking. It says they started consuming alcohol later than previous generations. So they drank less early on and are beginning, as they're aging through into their sort of early to mid-20s, sort of beginning to play catch-up to previous generations more than perhaps a lot of people anticipated.
Okay. Now, could you define what catching up means?
Yeah, again, so if we look at BevTrack data from IWSR, it shows that Gen Z participation, meaning people who have had an alcoholic beverage in the last 6 months, has risen from around two-thirds, so 66% in 2023, to about three-quarters, so mid-70% by autumn 2025. So put more simply, more younger people in the Gen Z generation are now consuming some alcohol. Not that frequently, but they are consuming. So this supports a theory that it's not participation rates that are driving the reduced alcohol consumption. Rather, it's that we're, again, repeating the same point, we drink on fewer occasions and less on average at those occasions.
Okay, because I'm a cynic and because I'm trying to work this out in my head, I mean, you know, one drink in the last 6 months, that could be a statistical artifact. That could just be, you know, more of us went to weddings because our friends are getting married or graduations or whatever.
Yeah, it could, but that would be a hell of a lot of weddings and graduations to underpin the volume of alcohol consumption. And as an aside, the rate of marriage or marriage rate in the UK, for example, as in many other countries in the world, is actually declining, bar a little mini spike post-COVID.
I wonder if the Champenoise have modelled that. I wonder if they go, weddings are declining. We're going to have to find more category entry points. That's us, literally, what we can do.
I'm so proud of you. Okay, so yes, let's continue. Now you've brought it up on my favourite topic of category entry points.
I use that term all the time now. Especially after you told me that your homegrown Gen Zs were like, Luli, our category entry point is here.
My work is done, Felicity.
Yes, that's right. All right, so carry on. I interrupted you.
Okay, yeah. So because category entry points. So because the majority of the volume of alcohol, champagne being a minor, an exception, but because, as I said, the total volume of alcohol is not consumed at weddings or graduations, the majority of the volume is every day, weekend catch-ups, you know, those kind of casual occasions. What happens on those occasions is what's really impacting the overall volumes, not the consumptions at wedding. But I will say the gap between what Gen Z versus other older adults are doing is narrowing. So there is still a difference, but that difference is narrowing. So it's more general in the population.
But it's a different style of drinking.
Yeah. It's less frequent, more selective, more occasion-led.
Yeah. I mean, one of the drinks that really fascinates me at the moment is a wine-based product called XXL. Now, it's a white that was originally drawn from Moldova. I don't know if they still do it. It's high alcohol and it's infused with flavours, so peach, lemon, whatever. And it's sold millions of cases in the last couple of years. But what's interesting about it is it's not so much a wine and it's not being consumed like a wine. It's more of a TikTok phenomenon because the label looks really good under lights. So it's not really about the liquid, it's about the performance, or at least that's my interpretation of why it's doing really well.
Yeah, I can really understand that because TikTok's definitely it's definitely occasion drinking.
Yeah, all right, so we've established that drinking patterns have changed, and so the obvious question now, Luli, why?
Okay, so, well, as if by magic, Felicity, I have the evidence and the data to hand.
Oh, how did I know that you might have that? You're a magician. Okay, yeah. So, and do you also have a framework?
Of course I do. Of course I do. You know me and my framework. Well, I call them this so grandly frameworks, but it's a setup. Let's call it a setup that we've used before. Do you remember Red Corner, Blue Corner?
I do, because I learned it came from boxing, something I didn't know about. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So let's start in the red corner. So this is the sort of premise that it's the health and wellness story that's driven this reduction in alcohol consumption. So calories, sleep, as you mentioned earlier, mental health control, sober curiosity. So it's basically the story people tell about why they're drinking less.
Yes. So this is the virtuous narrative. This is the dry January narrative.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then in the blue corner, we have the economic argument. So it's about higher prices. So there's a lot to do with tax in here, tax increases, and again, particularly in markets like the UK, which had a huge impact when the taxes rose significantly in the early 2000s on total volume in the UK. But it's also, and we sort of touched on this briefly, squeezed incomes, fewer nights, so leading to fewer nights out, more drinking at home. It's what actually happens, I guess, whether or not you've kind of read the wellness article.
Yeah, all right. So I know that we're going to come to the conclusion it's a bit of one and a bit of the other, but let's explore both of these corners. Let's start with the red corner. What does the data actually show? And by the way, as you probably know, I'm going to have opinions about this.
Good. So as you know, you're speaking to someone who was described recently as never knowingly under-opinionated. So please go wild with your opinions.
That's so hilarious. Okay, well, I mean, it's good. You know, if we didn't have opinions, this podcast would be very short, wouldn't it?
It would.
All right,
maybe our listeners would thank us. Anyway, here's the key shift. Moderation is normalizing, but abstinent peaks are kind of stalling.
Yeah, it's interesting. Okay, so what this means is people aren't doing the full hair shirt anymore. They're just kind of drinking less.
Exactly. And again, if you look at the latest IWSR consumer data, month-long abstinence from alcohol, particularly amongst Gen Z, actually falls marginally. So only in the last year, 2024 to the end of 2025, from 30% to 28% of that generation abstaining. So that's not huge, but it's also not saying it's flying upwards.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting phenomenon. I read somewhere, and I can't quote you where, it might have been Reddit, sorry, but because Joe Rogan didn't do Sober October last year, you know, he's a bro podcaster, he's very influential, overall participation by young men also dropped. So there could be a couple of things happening. One is that maybe this performative sobriety is losing momentum, but the other possibility is that because the sobriety has kind of become internalized, that you don't need a special occasion for it anymore. It's sort of moderate over the full year.
Well, first, performative sobriety. That's a very elegant way of putting it, Felicity.
Yeah, I wish I'd come up with that.
That's very clever. So it's not just Gen Z. So again, if we look at all adult drinkers, the share who have abstained entirely for the past 6 months also drops. So it's a all population trend that we're seeing, not just a Gen Z, which is often what we see in certainly the drinks industry headlines.
Okay, so I'm going to push back a bit because there is data that a significant number of people are dropping out of alcohol.
Okay, go on, love it. I love it when you disagree with me. Go on.
Well, it just is. I mean, you know, you can look at some of the public health data, for example, about the number of people who are deciding that they're going to go sober curious, and it's not an insignificant number.
Yeah, okay, it does, but it's more, as I've been saying before, if I look at lots of different data sources, it's more about the participation, not the abstinence. And that's what's really driving the kind of core trend.
Let's go back into this. So I'll go back to, this is why I'm going to push back after the sobriety. Okay, so but I'm going to push back because there is evidence pointing the other way.
Okay, go on. I love it when you disagree with me, Felicity.
So you've just talked about Gallup showing drinking participation in the US at a historic low. So that feels a little bit absent adjacent, you've got to admit.
It does, but it's mainly about participation and that rather than total abstinence.
Okay, maybe we're splitting hairs. I mean, Mintel and YouGov are still showing a strong interest in what, you know, people call sober curiosity. Mm. So the mental health, the calories, the emotional well-being. So the attitudes that are underpinning this sort of falling consumption certainly haven't gone away.
No, not at all. But what's changed is how people are acting on those attitudes.
Okay, so what are we saying here? We're saying that there's fewer grand gestures like the dry Januaries, but it's becoming, like I said earlier, it's becoming more part of everyday life.
Yeah, abstinent peaks were really loud. Moderation is quieter but stickier, and it is definitely more what we're seeing in actual behaviour.
All right, so let's go to the blue corner and let's talk about economics. What's the thesis here about why people are actually drinking less?
Okay, so this has very little to do with kind of kale or cold plunges or moral awakenings. Basically, the blue corner premise is that the reason we're drinking less is due to economic pressure, and that's what's doing the heavy lifting here.
Yeah, I actually think this is the strongest thing from everything I've read. You know, I've read a number of financial analyses in the last year, and the data is very clear, and I can see it in my own circle, I have to say.
Yeah, exactly. So multiple, as you were saying, multiple studies have shown that consumers are obviously still prioritising household necessities over alcohol spend.
The fools. And,
yeah, of course, even as consumer confidence is kind of nudging up a little bit.
Yeah, so to be serious, alcohol is discretionary spending and it's not a necessity like food or rent or petrol.
Yeah, and this is where Lawson Whiting, so he's Brown Foreman, was refreshingly blunt recently. I saw he recently said, and he was referring to alcohol consumption, that, and I quote, "It's not all wellness. A lot of 21 to 25-year-olds are just broke."
Yeah, I think that's really, really clear. It makes a lot of sense. And also, a lot of young people are still living at home, and that absolutely puts a crimp in your drinking. I remember. I'm older, but I still remember.
Yeah. And there's a stat that really kind of punctures the Gen Z killed alcohol storyline. So analysts at Barclays looked at alcohol spend as a share of income, and Gen Z basically spend the same proportion of their income on alcohol as everyone else.
Yeah, so Barclays reported that Gen Z in the US spend about 0.7% of income on alcohol, which is about the same that millennials and boomers spend.
Yeah, exactly. So basically they have less disposable income, smaller income, so effectively they're just poorer, same intent, just smaller wallet.
Yeah, the New York Times actually ran an interesting story about this and said they're much better at handling money. And so bars in New York are actually suffering because they don't like doing individual transactions for drinks on credit cards because they get a fee every time. But the Gen Zs are really annoying because they don't run a tab because they don't want to lose track of how much they're spending. So they go and they buy individual drinks. And so Gen Zs are actually costing the bars money. All right, so there is one more driver that we should mention, and it's not cultural economic. It's chemical.
You're right. Yeah, you are. And that's really annoying because now I'm thinking my red corner, blue corner framework, which works so beautifully with the two things we've been talking about, wellness and economics, and now you're introducing a third one.
I think for 2026, you're going to have to expand your frameworks, Lily. I think that's the takeaway here. You're going to have to complicate the narrative.
Okay, so I know I'm a bit deflated, but you're correct. So we'll need a third category.
Right. So how are you going to do it on your spreadsheet? It's going to be involving triangles, Venn diagrams, you're going to have a nervous breakdown. What's going to happen?
All three. So let's upgrade the metaphor so we can forget the boxing ring.
Oh, great. Goodbye, boxing ring.
Yeah, I know. And we can, I know. Let's move. Okay, I hope this is going to work. Let's move on to a three-legged stool. Okay, got it?
Okay, no, it doesn't work.
No, it does. I've got it. Are you ready? Because if you remove one leg, the whole thing falls over.
All right. Okay, so it does actually work. Okay, so there are three drivers at play and they work in combination.
Thank you. Yes. Do you think I recovered there?
Yes, you did. It was a wonderful metaphor, Lulu. Okay, so to recap, what's driving the reduction in alcohol consumption? Leg one, or our old red corner, which we've dispensed with for 2026, we have health, wellness, and identity. We've got calorie awareness. We've got sleep consciousness. We've got smartwatches that show you everything. And we've got, control.
Exactly.
Next, do the next one.
Okay, so leg two, which was our blue corner, is all about the economics, income pressure leading to fewer nights out, more drinking at home, less disposable income to spend on alcohol.
That's right. And now we have a third leg in all of this. And this is the most interesting one because there's questions about whether this is yet important or not, or how important.
Yeah.
And now we're talking about chemistry. We're talking about dopamine, appetite, and medication.
Yeah. So here you're talking about GLP-1 drugs and cannabis.
Yes, exactly. There is quite a lot of evidence that these drugs reduce alcohol consumption dramatically because they suppress dopamine release. They act on all sorts of... Do you know they actually even reduce gambling and shopping as well?
Wow. Gosh, no, I'd heard a little bit about that. But I think it's... So we're basically saying for shopping and gambling and alcohol consumption and food, it's not willpower. The reward just isn't firing in our brains.
That's right. And so it's been called a pretty strong signal that drinking behaviour and other behaviours are being biologically altered.
Okay, so that raises quite an awkward question, doesn't it? So it's if moderation comes from medication rather than choice, is that health or is that compliance?
Oh, see, I feel really strongly about this. I think people moralise these drugs. And I think... whatever works, it's great. I think framing abstinence as a moral good in itself is a bit of a problem. So a little riff about this. I think these drugs are really interesting because what they're doing is they're showing how much desires of all kinds are not actually choices. They're biological things. Yeah. And so I think they're really interesting. So anyway, I think the question about whether it's compliance, whether it's health is actually a red herring in some ways. It doesn't matter. What medicines that they do this?
Yeah, so cutting alcohol doesn't sort of automatically improve nutrition or relationships or mental well-being because sometimes, and we're seeing some writing and some thought coming out more about this, aren't we, that it kind of removes those social rituals and connections, which in and of themselves are really important.
Yes, in fact, anthropologist Robin Dunbar from Oxford University but he did quite a lot of work on how the alcohol actually helps social rituals as well. So yes, if you kick away this particular leg, what are the consequences going to be? It's very interesting.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. So the real question isn't whether Ozempic or sobriety will change drinking more.
No, it's more about whether biology kind of is quietly rewiring our behaviour faster than the cultural bit, the wellness bit we were talking about for, was it leg one red? Okay, we're getting quite complicated
we're
now.
We're losing track of the framework. Yes, and in fact, maybe the biology will rewire our culture. So the point being the GLP-1 drugs, the Ozempics and Mounjaros and so on, are the clearest example of that right now.
Yeah, and to be clear, the evidence here is genuinely interesting. Early studies, as you were saying, show they suppress the dopamine response to alcohol, which reduces the desire and therefore the consumption.
Yes, but I have to say, I think it's really important to be really sceptical about some of this because I've heard lots and lots of talks about GLP-1s and the potential effect on the market. And in some markets, they're clearly having a little bit of impact, like in Manhattan, you can read about teeny tiny cocktails. Mm-hmm. But I have not seen any hard data yet about these drugs having an actual society-wide impact.
Yeah, exactly. So we've got some strong signals, but not long-term population data yet. So we're seeing the evidence is saying suppression of desire, yes, but proven structural impact on alcohol markets yet to be proved.
Yeah, and that brings us to another one, which I think is quite contentious about this, which is cannabis, what impact is cannabis having?
Yeah, right, because if cannabis were going to have a kind of meaningful impact replacing alcohol, we'd already have seen that in the data because there are markets where cannabis has been legal for a while. So we should have started to see that coming through.
That's right, and we don't. So the not just IWSR, but Gallup and other market data consistently shows no significant long-term reduction in alcohol consumption attributable to cannabis in places like USA and Canada where it's been legalised.
Yeah, and we can see some substitution at the margins, but it's not a wholesale shift. So cannabis has been mostly additive rather than displacing alcohol at scale.
Yeah, and this makes sense to me because you use cannabis for a very different reason than you use alcohol. You know, alcohol is very much a social drug. But going back to the GLP-1s, these are a very different kettle of fish because they don't offer an alternative reward. They actually dull the reward system itself.
Yeah, which makes moderation less about discipline and more about sort of diminished desire, as we were saying. You're choosing not to drink. You just don't care as much.
Yeah, and so this is a very different kind of change. It's potentially a much more disruptive one if it scales. Now, I think there are some very good reasons why it might not. So first of all, these drugs are still made. I actually spent some time a couple of days ago looking at this and who's taking it. So in the United States at the moment, it's between 6 to 12% of the population.
Okay.
But the vast majority of these drugs are being taken by people who have diabetes. And that's a population that's probably moderating intake anyway. So diabetes and alcohol is a diabolical mix. So if you've got the disease, you might not be in the market for alcohol anyway. And so people who are taking it cosmetically, we don't know how many people are doing it for weight loss, but it's a very small percentage of the population so far.
I'm really glad you've cleared that up because I did not know that. So it's a good job we've got you always looking at the evidence on this stuff.
Well, I'm really interested because, you know, since I keep hearing about, there's always this thing. And there is some evidence that this is already affecting the food market. You know, and I think that's very interesting. But so far it's all been speculation about the alcohol market. And I'm like, I don't want to hear speculation. I want to see the hard numbers.
A woman after my own heart, Felicity.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, so this brings us back to where we started. So health isn't just about exclusion and the future of drinking isn't all about abstinence versus excess. It's about kind of this agency, context and choice and overall moderation.
All right, so if one of our listeners from Wine, Beer or Spirits is listening to this,
they're still with us.
The ultimate question is, should they be getting into No and Low?
Okay, so I'd focus on two things if it was me. So first, defensive. So No and Low options keep people in the brand family when they moderate. So when they drink less often or drink earlier or when they swap out a second drink.
So you keep them, you don't lose them, and you maintain brand awareness.
Exactly, brand awareness, one of the most important things we have in brand growth and brand success. So second is offensive. So it's kind of like the on-ramp for Gen Z in particular, especially via no alcohol cocktails, spritzes, lighter formats. Before they ever fully kind of enter the traditional alcohol category. So it's a way of bringing them in through your brands.
Yes, and I should say it's also that there is evidence that there are some people who will never enter the alcohol category, but you can still bring them under your brand umbrella. So anyway, I noticed that you'd snuck in another sports analogy.
Okay, I thought I got away with that one because you didn't mention it.
Yeah, you didn't get away with it.
Okay. So the real threats, as I see it, aren't dry January or sober October. Those aren't growing. They're stabilizing or in some markets are actually declining. This is structural moderation, not event or not total abstinence.
Yes, and I should say we're talking about this in terms of gloom and doom, but in some ways it's actually a good news story.
Yeah.
The whole time that I've been writing about wine in the last 25 years, I heard this thing about, you know, we want people to drink less but better. And it turns out people are drinking less and better, which is better for the environment, it's better for them. So, so what we're getting is people drinking less often, they're drinking less per occasion, and the abstinent months are still there, but probably what's more important is the zebra striping, the swapping between alcohol and no alcohol.
Yeah, and exactly. You talk about my in-house Gen Z correspondents. So three of them.
My homegrown ones.
You were smart enough to get started
with your own little.
I got my own focus group. So I had three of them over here for dinner this week, nieces and nephews. And what was really interesting is in previous years, they have chosen to do dry January. So when they turn up for dinner, I'm like, right, is anybody drinking alcohol? Is it not a non-alcohol? We've got all the choices. And interestingly, two of them were like, yeah, I'm just drinking. I'm trying to drink less. So one was like, I'm not drinking.
Is this validation bias? You're saying that, you know, dry January's dropped off just because your homegrowns aren't doing it anymore?
It just made me think when you said that about the sort of zebra striping, and it just occurred to me that, you know, one of them was like, I'm not drinking during the week, and the other one of the others said, oh, I'm just trying to drink less. So previously they would have drunk nothing during January. So I guess it supports what we've been saying.
Yeah, can I just drop in with a personal thing? So I've been told this bit about dry January, that you'll lose weight and your skin will look fantastic. My alcohol consumption has dropped off a planet. And I'll tell you what, my skin does not look better. It's a complete lie. Don't fall for it, listen.
That's called aging, Felicity.
Oh, thanks, Lily. Yeah.
You're welcome. So I'm with you.
Thank you very much. All right. So going back to economics quickly.
Yes.
So economics is about intentions always rise when money is tight and it falls when it loosens. So this really is somewhat a story about health, but it's mostly a story about affordability.
Mm. Yeah.
So where do you see, give us a prognostication. What's the future for Noah Lowe?
If I knew what that word meant, I might be able to. I'm assuming you're asking me what's the future. So let's anchor. I think it's really important that we anchor this in some market reality. So no alcohol is still really, 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 really small.
Yeah, the noise is really, really, really loud, but yeah, the numbers are not. All right.
Exactly. So about 2% of the and this is in key markets globally, again, IWSR data. So about 2% of beer is no alcohol. So 2% of the beer category.
Yeah.
For sparkling wine, it's around the same. So around 2% of total sparkling wine is zero. But for still wines, that's well less than 1% of all wines sold are zero. And for spirits, it's almost negligible as a percentage of the volume of overall spirits sold.
Though I have to say, it's some of that is because the beer is much better analog than the wine and spirits are.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it's just grounding us, because if we're talking sort of industry stories and conversations, you know, Noah and Lowe gets proportionally a lot more airtime coverage than the actual market size would suggest.
All right, so let me sum this up, which is people haven't stopped drinking. They've just changing the way they drink.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So on that cheerful note, we've solved another problem, and we will see you next time on A Question of Drinks.
So as always, send us any questions, which I'll look at, that you'd like us to explore, to aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send us any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.